17 hours. 17 hours it would take you to read the end user license agreement on the 13 most popular applications that most computer users use. If you were an average reader reading 240 words per minute and you went and read every single bit of the fine print, it would take you 17 hours to read documents about Microsoft Word, to read about how you use LinkedIn or Facebook, to use Gmail or Twitter. All these apps are included as part of the 13 most frequently used applications. And it would take you 17 hours to read all the agreements. But of course, I don't have to tell you that because I know every single one of you, when you hit agree, would never hit agree without reading every single word of the end user license agreement, right? No? You mean you skim over or just click the box and skip all that fine print? What about the Bible's fine print? And no, I'm not talking about the little font in some Bibles. I'm talking about the hidden things in the Bible, the gotcha passages. Is there parts in the Bible where God has hidden those sorts of scary passages? Do you have to pay for your firstborn child? Well, if it's a son, it's two turtle doves. Is there some weird test for how to figure out if someone's been an adulteress or not? Well, yes, there's a bitter drink that you're supposed to mix up and have her drink. What's the hidden cost for that sin that you committed this morning? Only your life. Of course, these are not really what I'm talking about with the fine print. The fine print is what we often call the hidden gotcha phrases. Oftentimes, the legalese or the information that goes on that says, hey, if you use Microsoft Word and we decide we want it, we can have your firstborn child or your house. And that's hidden down in paragraph 24 of subsection 3. That's what we think of when we think of fine print. But the question that we want to ask today is there fine print to being a disciple of Jesus's? Is Jesus going to hide the real cost of following him? Over here, he's telling you, oh, I'm going to give you salvation. Oh, I'm going to forgive you your sins. Oh, I'm going to give you heaven. And then, boom, here's what really is going to cost you to be my disciple. But I'm not going to tell you that until you're already committed. See, when we look at Luke chapter 14, we realize that Jesus is actually the opposite of doing the bait and switch of fine print. In fact, Jesus wants everybody to know right up front what is it going to cost to be his disciple. Turn with me to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, we have Jesus interacting with a large crowd. In fact, here in verse 25, we read, now large crowds were going along with Jesus. And he turned to them and said, now, Jesus has a large group of people that are following him. He is the epitome that we would call a successful preacher. People just can't stay away from this guy. He's got interesting things to say. He's got fascinating stories. He's got challenging things that really make you think. And just for good measure, there's a lot of controversy thrown in between him and the pervading religious leaders. What's not to love about this Jesus guy? Well, apparently a lot of people are following Jesus. You see, if Jesus were what we call an influencer today on social media, he'd be telling everybody, all right, make sure you go tell your friends. Make sure you subscribe to my YouTube channel. Make sure you're back here for next week's message. Give me more people. Bring me more folks. Now, from our point of view, sometimes we're the same way, where we're like, hey, let's bring more people into the building. Let's talk to more people about Jesus. And it's all with the right motivation, right? We want more people to hear about being a disciple of Jesus. More is better, right? Well, in this crowd, there's a lot of people that really aren't interested in being his disciple. He's got some people that are just walking up with their hands out, saying, Jesus, I want. Jesus, give me. Jesus, help. There are some people that have just heard about Jesus, and they're kind of curious. Oh, what's this about? What's this new rabbi teaching? They're just curious. There are some folks, they hate Jesus. And they are watching him like a hawk, trying to catch him in some slip so they can bring him up on charges. So they can discredit him or say, did you see that thing that Jesus said or did? We need to cancel him. We need to kick him off Twitter. We need to ignore what he has to say. Jesus has a few friends that are hanging out. People that are just along for the ride. They've been swept up. But then there's a few, a small group, that they are there because they want to hear Jesus and then apply what Jesus says. They want to be effective as followers of Jesus. We call these disciples. This is what the New Testament calls them. You're probably familiar with the word Christian. Well, Christian is a Bible word, but it's used very, very infrequently. The word the Bible likes to use is disciple. And I like the illustration that a disciple is like a modern-day apprentice. Imagine you want to become an electrician. Well, you have to be an apprentice electrician first. Now, before you go wiring things in a house, you have to do some book learning. You need to learn about electricity and resistance and gauges of wiring and different materials of wiring. You have to sit and study some books. But it's more than just book learning. You need to go and follow the example of the master electrician. See what he does or see what he's instructing you to do. Then you need to start putting it into practice, trying it out. And the master electrician is going to say, oh, go back and read this book and see how to do it a little better. Or here, let me show you and tweak this. Or he might send a different apprentice who's a little further along to help you wire that thing just right. Being a disciple is being an apprentice of Jesus. And so Jesus has all these crowds and he wants apprentices. He wants disciples. And so Jesus is in the disciple recruitment business. Now there's a saying that we have in the army when life is really hard at basic training. The drill sergeants will be yelling at you, you're doing push-ups, you're getting sunburned, you're tired, you're exhausted, your arms hurt, you're cranky. And the drill sergeant might turn with a smile and say, what do you guys say to all these push-ups I'm giving you? Thank you, drill sergeant. Thank you for the opportunity to grow and increase. His little saying, he'll turn away, he'll smile and say, don't thank me, thank your recruiter. Your recruiter's the one that got you here. Your recruiter's the one that put you in the position. I'm just here to train. Jesus is a recruiter of disciples. Now, I want you to imagine the picture up here in two different conversations. There could be two 100% different conversations with two 100% different results. The first conversation is the one that probably was really happening in this picture. Hey, if you sign up for the Army right now, we've got a sign-on bonus of $15,000 for this job, and this job. And if you want to go to infantry, it's $20,000. But we're also going to pay for your college. And we'll give you your first duty station. You go to Hawaii or to Germany or some exotic place around the world. You know what? We can even put you in this unit. I know this unit. They don't deploy very often, so you don't have to worry about going off to war. Oh, you've got some obligations. We'll send you to basic training in the fall. That's conversation number one. Soldier signs up. Conversation number two. Sign this piece of paperwork. You don't need to pack anything. There's a bus out back. You're going to be at basic training for the next 10 to 12 weeks. Then you're going to go to more training for another 16 weeks. You will go to Fort Bliss, Texas. That's El Paso, for those of you that don't know where that is. Not one of the first destinations most soldiers want to go. But don't worry, you won't be at Fort Bliss for very long because that unit is going to Iraq. And this unit, in the last three times it's deployed, has had a 75% chance that you come back with mental health issues. You have a 65% chance of coming back with some sort of physical disability. They have more Purple Hearts in that unit than any other unit in the Army. And you have a 52% chance with the unit that we're going to send you with of not coming back at all. That guy signs up for the Army. Now, recruit number one, with all the incentives, does he want to be in the Army? Yeah. But he only wants all the nice things. Recruit number two, you can send him anywhere. Because he's there to serve. He's there to be the Army. That's kind of what Jesus is doing here. He is recruiting disciples. But a disciple needs to be committed. A disciple needs to be in it for the long haul. A disciple needs to be in there when the going gets tough, when people don't like him. A disciple needs to be that second type of recruit. And so Jesus is not going to sit up here and wade you through 17 hours of fine print before you figure out how hard it might be to be a disciple. He's got all these crowds, and he turns to these crowds, and he's going to tell them what the fine print is. But he's telling them up front. He says, this is what it's going to take if you want to be my disciple. In verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. So Jesus expects us to count the cost. And so he's going to tell us the cost up front. And so verses 26 and 27, he tells us what this intense cost of being disciples. Now, there's a lot of blessings of being a disciple, but that's not what today's message is. Today's message is, you need to be committed. You need to be ready for what it might just cost you. And so he starts off with a verse that really trips a lot of people up here. In fact, I like to tell folks that if you take anything out of context of the Bible, you can pretty much get the Bible to say whatever you want. God is love. Well, Jesus just told me to hate all my family. You don't believe me? Luke chapter 14, verse 26. Hate your father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister. You know, hate yourself. Why not? And people are sitting there going, that can't be right. You must mean something different. Well, a little bit. Matthew chapter 10, he's saying the same thing, but he helps explain a little bit more. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, he says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Doesn't Jesus listen to Christmas carols? It's about peace. He says, no, it's not about peace. It's about swords. It's about war. You know, right now our country's having this debate again about whether or not it's appropriate to have assault weapons for the civilian population. And gun control advocates rightfully say, and if anyone disagrees with this, they're wrong. They rightfully say that assault rifles, at least some of these assault rifles, are designed for nothing more than killing humans. Now, you can kill animals, you can hunt with these assault rifles, but they are designed to kill humans. There's no question about that. The military contracted to have these things designed. Now, that's not to say we should get rid of them, but that is what they are for. Now, the assault rifle of the first century was a sword. Could you plow a field with a sword? Sure, you could. But that's not what it's for. It's for war, for attacking people. And Jesus says, I am bringing war to the earth. But the battlefields are not the fields of Parthia or the fields of Rome. The battlefields are your home. The enemies that are going to be attacking you are not some foreigners. They are the people closest to you, your family members. He says, for I come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be the members of his household. Jesus knew that when he comes, he's teaching people, there's going to be friction in families. Some people are going to want to follow Jesus, and some people are going to hate them. So he says, the one who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. The one who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. That's what he says in Luke 14, only a shorter version, I think for that shock value that we sometimes get when we read this. It's got to be as if you hate your family with how much you love me, with how committed you are. But why? Well, see, when you become a Christian, Jesus says there's going to be conflict. Even the people that are closest to you are going to struggle with that decision. Now, some of us were raised in families that value the Bible, value the Lord, and we're encouraging them towards salvation. And this might be a struggle of a passage to relate to. I grew up in a home that most people would describe that way. Valued the Bible, went to Sunday school, valued Jesus. But when I was taught the way of the Lord more correctly, I became a Christian, and my family resisted that. Oh, you're caught in a cult, Gabe. Oh, this is just a phase, Gabe. Oh, that's not right. And to this day, my family doesn't really care for me that much. I mean, they love me. I'm invited to Thanksgiving sometimes. But there is war. But maybe you were blessed with a family that didn't treat you that way. They were encouraging you to the Lord. Your closest friends, though, might not. You see, these are the relationships that are close to you. Your children maybe someday might walk away from the Lord and try to draw you away from the Lord. And Jesus says, you need to be so committed to me that no matter what they do, they can't draw you away, because it's like you hate them when compared to the love you have for me. That's why he says, I have to be the most important relationship in your life. But then in verse 27 here, he says, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me, he cannot be my disciple. Now, you might have a cross on your necklace. You might have a cross on your car. We have a cross on a window behind this screen, right? Crosses are nice decorations. They show how committed to Jesus I am. Jesus died on the cross, right? None of those things went through the minds of the people when they heard this the first time. Now, Jesus might realize or have in his mind as he's saying this, I know I'm going to a cross, but that is not what this crowd heard. A cross was a form of execution, and it wasn't a pleasant form. Right? You know, we have pharmacy companies that are stopping states from committing capital punishment simply by not giving a medicine. Now, these bad guys are put to sleep, and then their heart is stopped. I can't imagine a better way to have to die. Crucifixion is not that. Crucifixion is horrible. It's awful. It might last the better part of a week. One time, Rome, just to make a point about these revolting slaves, took thousands of slaves, put them on crosses alongside a road. That's like lining Fish Creek with a bunch of people, nailing them to boards and letting them sit up there for days on end, screaming and moaning, just to prove a point. That's what crucifixion was. It's excruciating. That's where we get our word excruciating from. Crucifixion. It's excruciating. You end up dying. It's shameful. You're up there, probably naked, for everyone to see. Where was Jesus crucified? Not in the back alley, but on a hill, so everyone could see. Don't be this guy. Oh, and who did that? That's right, the Romans. The people that they consider are enslavers. The bad guys, the worst of the worst. Jesus, you're saying I have to be willing to do, like, submit to enslavement, to excruciating pain, to death, to shame? Now, let's just think for a moment and say this isn't hyperbole. Hyperbole is that way of saying something in extreme to prove a point. Like my kids, I'm starving, Dad. Well, they haven't actually starved, not yet. We say it all the time, right? Oh, I love this ice cream flavor. You have some relationship issues, my friend. No, it's hyperbole. Let's just think for a moment. What if Jesus is not saying hyperbole? Let's just think for a moment. One of these people in this crowd listening to this person in about 35 years will be nailed to a cross, his arms pulled as far as they can go, nailed to a cross, flipped upside down until he dies. But that's Peter. That's what happened to Peter. So one of the people who heard this literally had to go to a cross. How many others literally had to go to crosses? Now we have modern day believers that are being put on crosses in town squares when ISIS comes to town. We have modern day believers that when they are rounded up, they're put on the side of a shore of the ocean and their heads are cut off. There is a truth to this level of commitment. If you are so committed that I said, the minute you go out that door, someone's going to capture you, you're going to go out to Bond Park, and on live television, they're going to cut your head off. If you want to, you can go out the back door. You don't have to have that level of commitment. That is what Jesus says your level of commitment needs to be. So if you are so committed that you're ready to die for Jesus in an excruciating way, is your career going to get in the way? Is that 401k going to get in the way? Is going out with the boys on Saturday night going to get in the way? Is the ridicule of your mom saying, yo, that's such a superstitious religion, or I can't believe you got caught up in that cult, is that going to get in the way if you are so committed to Jesus you'll die on a cross? No. It won't get in the way. And that's the point. Now, I'm grateful to the Lord that I don't think any of us will literally have to be nailed to a cross. But this hyperbole is not hyperbole for some. And it's certainly not hyperbole for the level of commitment Jesus expects from us. We have to count this cost. But Jesus wants us to think before we get started about this cost. He continues with two illustrations. He says, for which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation he's not able to finish, all who are watching him will begin to ridicule him, saying, this person began to build and was not able to finish. Well, what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he's strong enough with 10,000 men to face the one coming against him with 20,000? Otherwise, while the other's still far away, he sends a delegation. He requests terms of peace. So then none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Jesus gives these two illustrations to calculate the cost. Think about what you're getting into, even before you start. Now, these two illustrations have two totally different risk factors involved. One of them, he talks about a building project. It's probably something that was supposed to be built on my property because it's like what happens in my house. I start building, and then I'm like, oh, that's expensive, and it doesn't get finished. It's probably using wood, actually. You think about how wood prices are nowadays. Over here on this side, though, you have a king. A king that sees an invading army. Can I defeat this army? Well, the king doesn't calculate correctly. What's the cost? Lots of people are going to die. And worse yet, the country is probably going to become a part of a different country. Ridicule because you didn't finish your project. Death and the change of regime. Those aren't even comparable as far as the risks involved, right? But the process is the same. Before you get started, think about the cost. Can I pay that cost? Before I get started, think about the cost. Can I pay that cost? Today we're thinking about something so much more important than a little ridicule for a building project or a little country's government regime change. To be a disciple of Jesus has an eternal consequence to your soul. An eternal consequence for your soul and for the souls of the people to your left and right. Jesus says, same process though. Sit down, think about the cost. And what is it going to cost you? Well, just a small little thing. Everything. Again, he says, if you're not ready to give up all your possessions, you cannot be my disciple. Notice he says, he doesn't say, if you do not hate your mother, brother, wife, sister, give your own life, you'll be kind of a mediocre disciple. If you don't carry your cross and follow me, you'll be a so-so disciple. If you don't give up all your possessions, you'll be a kind of disciple. He doesn't say that. He says, you cannot be my disciple. Now he punctuates it with one last illustration here. This is the passage. Oftentimes we forget that this is part of the same conversation. Beginning of verse 34, he says, therefore, salt is good. But if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless, either for the soil or the manure pile, so it is thrown out. One who has ears to hear, let him hear. We need to consider this cost. Now, this illustration is showing us what happens when we don't count the cost. Oh, I just became a disciple because I was at summer camp and everybody else was getting baptized. Oh, I became a Christian because I'm American, I'm Christian. Red, white, blue, and the cross. Jesus says that's not going to cut it. You need to count the cost. Because what happens if you don't count the cost? In this illustration, salt equals disciples. Salt has one purpose, to be salty. Would you just sprinkle rocks on top of your food if it wasn't salty? Well, I have bad dental bills if you do. Of course not. It's salty. That's the only reason we put it on. If it ceases to be salty, it's not good for anything. It's not even worth putting in the manure piles. It's going to just ruin the dirt that you put it on. So what is a disciple supposed to be? If salt is salty, in this context, a disciple is committed. A disciple is committed. You know what a disciple is who's not really committed to the Lord? They are salt without taste. They are useless to the Lord. If you don't have commitment to Jesus, what can he do with you? Because the minute he sends you out to the field and you hit some sort of resistance from someone who's close to you, you'll buckle. If you go out here at Bond Park, they're holding up picket signs against Christians, and suddenly someone starts getting beat up and say, "Are you also a Christian?" You say, "No, no, I'm not." God can't use that. He's not going to. Be a committed disciple. Discipleship is about commitment. What are you going to do when that money temptation comes up? What are you going to do when there's a business decision that might not be pleasing to the Lord? What are you going to do when you want to move to a town where there's no church or Christians there? What are you going to do when suddenly science has some answer that you don't know how to answer in the moment? What are you going to do? You see, all of us have different things. I can only come up with the imagination parts that occur to me, right? You know, money's a temptation for me. Having good relationships is a temptation for me. Science can make my brain hurt, but what is it to you that Satan's going to try and infiltrate your life? You see, there's nothing Satan can infiltrate you with if you are so committed that not a relationship is more important than Jesus, not a commitment is more important than Jesus, not a possession is more important than Jesus. There's nothing he can tempt you away from the Lord. We have to be committed. Now, this is something that starts at the beginning, but it continues through the end of life. And if we don't have this commitment when we start, we probably won't finish. If we don't have this in the middle, we're going to hit some bumps. And if we don't have this towards the end, all the work we've done up to this point in time is forgotten. Resolve to be a salty disciple. You're probably going to hear a preacher say that, right? Usually we think of salty as like kind of a little iffy person. Someone's got no control over their mouth and the way they act. But no, in Jesus' context, be a salty disciple, a useful disciple, a committed disciple. If you're committed, God can use you in your circumstances. If you're committed, you will survive that trial. You may not enjoy it, but you'll survive it. If you're committed, you can be a disciple, an apprentice, a follower, a learner, a useful asset to Jesus. I hope that we all have this level of commitment. And if you've been struggling, I hope that this is just a reminder that this is what Jesus wants. This is what Jesus is expecting from us. If you need some encouragement, it's because maybe you're struggling with being salty. Maybe you're struggling with being committed because of a relationship or a temptation in life, and you need encouragement from your brethren, then our invitation is open for you to come forward so we can pray with you, so we can encourage you, so we can tell you that you're not alone. Satan might be trying to get at you, but you are not alone. And we are committed with you. We're standing shoulder to shoulder with you and want to encourage you. There's some way that we can be that encouragement for you today. You need public encouragement. You're welcome to come forward during our invitation. If you need to talk privately, you're welcome to come talk with me at the end of service, and we'll have that conversation. We'll be praying for you. We'll be encouraging you. Well, let's all stand together.